Welcome, and thank you for joining us for a brand new deep dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and it's my pleasure to be your guide as we navigate the most compelling stories of the day.
And I'm Sam Astor, here to help unpack these complex narratives, connect the threads, and offer the insights that truly matter.
Our mission, as always, is to take your sources, distill them, and give you a shortcut to being genuinely well-informed, uncovering surprising facts and the deeper context behind the headlines.
Exactly. And today, our stack of sources is a comprehensive edition of The Wall Street Journal for Saturday, August 9th, 2025.
As you know, the Journal covers an immense range of topics, from global markets to cultural
It
shifts.
really does.
Our aim today is to bring you a focused, in-depth exploration of the most significant political, economic, societal, and cultural articles within this specific edition.
We want to help you understand their impact and, maybe spark some further thought on the issue shaping our world right now.
It's quite a snapshot of a bustling week, and we've definitely got a lot to explore.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's begin by pulling back the curtain on the intricate dance of power and policy, maybe starting at the very heart of the American economy, the geopolitical and economic landscape, navigating power and policy.
We're talking, of course, about the Federal Reserve. It's currently under intense scrutiny as the search for its next chair continues.
And this isn't just about monetary policy decisions, is it? It seems profoundly about ideological alignment and, well, the very soul of this critical institution.
Right. The context of this search is particularly revealing. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent is leading the charge to find the next Fed chair.
And what's interesting is that Bessent himself was initially considered for the role, wasn't he? But he opted out earlier this week.
He did. President Trump noted Bessent's desire to remain in his current position, which paradoxically now puts him in an incredibly influential place in shaping the central bank's future leadership.
So who are the names circulating for this immensely powerful role? Who's in the running?
Well, we have James Bullard, who previously served as the president of the St. Louis Fed. He's now the dean of Purdue University's Business School.
Ah, Bullard. It was
Yeah.
actually Bullard who, back in 2019, recommended Christopher Waller, then his research director, as a candidate for the Fed board.
That's right. And Waller was indeed nominated by Trump. Bullard himself has openly expressed interest in the top job should the opportunity arise.
Okay, who else?
Then there's Mark Summerlin. He's a former George W. Bush advisor who now runs his own economic advisory firm. Apparently, he's been interacting with Bessent.
And Waller.
And naturally, Christopher Waller, a current Fed board member, he interviewed with Bessent recently. While he apparently impressed some, others are already casting him as, a bit of a long shot.
Beyond these known contenders, though, the real potential for a profound shift would seem to come from a new nomination.
Yes, President Trump has just put forward Steven Marin, who currently heads the White House Council of Economic Advisers. He's up for a newly opened vacancy on the Fed's Board of Governors.
A vacancy that unexpectedly became available after Adriana Kugler's surprising resignation last week.
Exactly. And Marin is hardly a consensus pick. His past views are, let's just say, controversial.
How so?
Well, he's openly questioned the Fed's institutional legitimacy. He's gone so far as to accuse officials of political motivation in their decisions, even when they frame them as purely economic.
Right. And he also coined that term, tariff derangement syndrome, clearly taking aim at those who criticize the president's trade policies.
But perhaps most strikingly, Marin actually wrote a paper arguing that all top Fed officials should be subject to at-will dismissal by the White House.
Wow. That's a direct challenge to the Fed's long-held tradition of independence, isn't it?
Absolutely. If Marin's appointment goes through, it could significantly impact the Fed's famously consensus-driven culture and its highly influential research staff.
Yeah, the concern is that it could push central bankers to increasingly vote along party lines rather than solely on, pure economic analysis.
Imagine a scenario where the nuanced interpretation of economic data takes a backseat to political expediency.
It would fundamentally challenge how the Fed has operated for decades and potentially erode public trust in its nonpartisan role.
It certainly represents a departure from established norms. And speaking of partisan views, Marin made a memorable social media post last fall.
Ah, yes, I remember that. He specifically criticized the Fed's decision to lower interest rates from a two-decade high, didn't he?
He did, labeling it deep state and corrosive of our democracy.
Strong words.
Yeah.
Though he later softened that language, describing it as hyperbolic.
Right, but his initial sentiment was quite clear. He was so baffled by the Fed's actions, coming just 2 months before presidential election, that he concluded their motivations must be political.
Which is a direct challenge to the core principles of the Fed, something Chairman Powell and most of his colleagues categorically reject.
Moving from the highest echelons of monetary policy, let's explore another area where the government is actively asserting its influence in finance. The future of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and this ongoing debanking debate.
Okay. The Trump administration is preparing for an initial public offering, an IPO, of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, slated for this year.
And some officials believe this could be an absolutely massive undertaking, potentially raising around $30 billion.
That's the figure being floated, yeah. And valuing the firms at roughly $500 billion or more combined. It's huge.
Okay, maybe give us a little background. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they're these enormous government-sponsored enterprises that bundle and sell mortgages.
Correct. And they've been under government control since the 2008 financial crisis. Their very stability, their existence in the market, really hinges on a government-backed guarantee that protects investors from losses.
So a crucial question is whether they would remain under conservatorship post-IPO, and I guess what the nature of that guarantee would be.
Exactly. And there's considerable market skepticism surrounding the ambitious timeline for such a complex offering. Bankers are understandably wary.
And analysts too, right? Wells Fargo particularly issued stark warnings.
They did, stating quite directly that the market cannot function without the implied guarantee, and any release effort must preserve this backstop.
They fear that without an explicit, clear guarantee, forced selling by both domestic and foreign holders could destabilize not just mortgage-backed securities, but the entire housing market.
Which poses a fundamental challenge. How can an IPO of this magnitude proceed without explicitly confirming this essential guarantee?
That ambiguity around the guarantee is absolutely critical. President Trump has stated he wants the firms to retain the government guarantee even after a public offering.
Right, but he hasn't detailed how that would actually work. It presents significant legislative and accounting challenges.
Meanwhile, the Treasury still holds warrants for about 80% of their common stock and preferred shares.
Yeah. Although, interestingly, some investors, like Bill Ackman's Pershing Square, have been betting on this privatization for a long time. They hold a roughly 10% stake in both firms' common shares, anticipating precisely this outcome.
Okay, shifting slightly, we're also seeing the government's hand in finance through the contentious debanking debate, the denial of financial services based on politics or religion.
Right. President Trump recently issued an executive order explicitly aimed at preventing this practice.
This order follows several high-profile allegations. For example, President Trump's family business sued Capital One,
claiming their accounts were closed after January 6, 2021. Yeah. He's also asserted that other large banks rejected $1 billion in his deposits.
But this isn't just a personal grievance, is it? The article suggests a broader pattern.
Definitely. Venture capitalist Marc Andreessen has highlighted awareness of 30 tech entrepreneurs who've been debanked in the last 4 years. The Alliance Defending Freedom maintains a list of conservative groups reporting similar issues.
And the Blockchain Association identified over 30 concrete cases within the digital asset industry.
So yeah, it suggests something wider is going on.
The question then becomes, what's driving this? Banks often point fingers at regulators, claiming they're pressured to cut off certain groups.
They draw parallels to how Biden officials reportedly leaned on social media companies to censor dissent.
However, the article also highlights the Bank Secrecy Act and Know Your Customer rules. These mandate banks to monitor activity and file suspicious activity reports, or SARs, to prevent money laundering.
And this is where the issue gets particularly complex, right? It blurs the lines between regulation and potential overreach.
And this is where a House Judiciary Committee report from last fall comes into play.
Yes. It detailed allegations that the FBI suggested banks file SARs on individuals deemed suspicious due to perceived ties to the January 6th Capitol riot.
The implication being that this was a way to investigate people without obtaining warrants, essentially using banks as a kind of dragnet.
Which has spurred a bipartisan call for reform. Senator Tim Scott, along with Representatives Andy Barr and Richie Torres, have proposed legislation.
They want to prohibit financial regulators from considering reputational risk as a basis for action and reform the Bank Secrecy Act itself.
It's an issue where the political stakes are high for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, the possibility of future administrations weaponizing these tools against their opponents is a very real and concerning prospect.
From the inner workings of finance, let's zoom out to the global stage, where trade tensions continue to simmer and supply chains are shifting dramatically under geopolitical pressure.
Yeah, President Trump is clearly escalating pressure on Moscow. He's just announced a hefty 50% additional tariff on India for its continued significant import of Russian oil.
And he's considering similar punishments for China, too.
Right. This move takes place against the backdrop of a recent proposal from Putin to the U.S. Special Envoy, Steve Witkoff.
Putin's proposal would require Ukraine to hand over eastern Ukraine, the Donbass, without much commitment from Russia beyond just stopping the fighting.
Basically, yes. And European and Ukrainian officials, understandably, view this with skepticism, fearing it's simply a ploy to avoid new EU sanctions.
The economic implications of these U.S. moves are substantial. They overlap with existing EU sanctions,
which already cap Russian oil sales at 15% below market rate and have expanded sanctions on Russia's shadow fleet of tankers.
The strategic thinking, as one scholar from the Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center observes, is that Putin's pain endurance is much higher than the West's.
Meanwhile, India has loudly complained about what it perceives as double standards, pointing out that Washington continues to buy Russian uranium hexafluoride, and the EU remains a key buyer of Russian liquefied natural gas.
This international trade dynamic connects directly to a major supply chain shift we're seeing. Apple is increasingly relying on India for iPhone production.
That's right. The plan is apparently to more than double India's capacity in the next 2 years. This allows Apple to increasingly supply iPhones to the U.S. market from India instead of China.
This move truly highlights Tim Cook's strategic acumen, doesn't it? Navigating these treacherous trade waters.
Definitely. Apple recently committed to a $100 billion investment in the U.S., which conveniently granted them an exemption from new global tariffs.
Meaning a 20% tariff on iPhones imported from China, but zero on those from India. That's a significant competitive advantage.
Huge. However, India faces considerable challenges in truly matching China's manufacturing prowess. China has, what, a two-decade head start?
Yeah, in building a dense ecosystem of supply chains, talent, and infrastructure, they currently produce over 200 million iPhones a year.
India needs massive new infrastructure development, extensive workforce training, supportive government policies. Plus, most smartphone components are still imported into India, and many face tariffs unless the finished phones are ultimately exported.
What's crucial to understand, though, is that this ramping up of production in India actually predates Trump's second-term tariffs by years.
Right, which indicates a deeply embedded, long-term strategic planning move by Apple, not just a reaction. It shows real foresight in anticipating these global trade shifts.
Okay, let's pivot now to U.S. foreign policy and domestic enforcement priorities, which appear to be undergoing some dramatic and, well, contentious shifts.
We're seeing President Trump's directive for the Pentagon to prepare options for using military force against Latin American drug cartels.
And the White House has designated these cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. That's a significant conceptual shift, isn't it?
It really is. It changes how they're viewed and potentially how they're addressed by the U.S. government.
So what does this military force look like in practice? Are we talking boots on the ground?
The options under discussion include things like special forces operations, intelligence support, and precision targeting. Importantly, all of this would need to be coordinated with Mexico and other foreign partners.
The head of U.S. Northern Command has even requested expanded capabilities for U.S. Special Forces to work more closely with Mexican troops.
Right. And Representative Dan Crenshaw, he's on the House Intelligence Committee, he views this as an insurgency that demands a military response.
Mexico itself, reportedly at the urging of President Sheinbaum, has approved Green Berets to train Marine infantry at a naval base.
And this isn't just a sudden impulse. The CIA has apparently been quietly working with Mexican authorities for years, providing funding and intelligence.
And the Office of the Director of National Intelligence identified drug flow as the top national security challenge the U.S. faces, even ahead of China or Russia.
It really signals a fundamental shift in paradigm. Secretary of State Marco Rubio states it's no longer simply a law enforcement issue, but clearly a national security issue.
Okay, turning to domestic enforcement, we're seeing FBI Director Kash Patel aggressively reshaping the Bureau.
Yeah, he's been forcing out agents involved in investigations that have upset the president and his supporters. He recently fired Stephen Jensen,
whom Patel himself had only appointed head of the Washington field office back in April.
Exactly. This has, unsurprisingly, sparked significant concern.
The FBI's involvement in tracking down those Texas Democratic lawmakers who fled the state to block redistricting legislation, that's a prime example of what's worrying former officials.
Right. These lawmakers haven't been accused of any crime, and the FBI has remained silent on their authority or any potential criminal offense.
Christopher O'Leary, a former senior FBI official, expressed deep concern about what he calls a vindictive campaign playing out.
He fears it could severely impact agency morale and routine work due to the loss of decades of experience in critical areas like counterintelligence and terrorism.
It really raises important questions about the independence and impartiality of the Bureau and its vital functions.
Absolutely.
Amidst all these turbulent geopolitical shifts, it's quite interesting to note a surprising soft spot in U.S. foreign policy, the relationship with the United Kingdom.
Yeah, Vice President Vance's visit to the U.K., his longest overseas trip since taking office, is being seen as a clear sign of this surprising soft spot for the U.K. within the Trump administration.
It suggests a good working relationship is developing with its center-left leaders, despite, you know, ideological differences that might otherwise cause friction.
Vance held a bilateral meeting with UK Foreign Secretary David Lammy at Chivening. They discussed critical issues like the war in Gaza and President Trump's upcoming meeting with Vladimir Putin regarding Ukraine.
The special relationship between the U.S. and U.K. seems remarkably resilient, doesn't it? Weathering Trump's often disruptive term better than many initially feared.
It does. The U.K. was, notably, the first country to strike a new trade agreement with the Trump team and has received the lowest tariffs of any country at 10%.
Trump himself has shown a personal connection, warmly welcoming U.K. Prime Minister Keir Starmer at the White House, offering praise.
He even recently visited Scotland to open a new golf course, talking about his love for Scotland and his grandmother's roots there.
And he's planning a full state visit in September to Windsor Castle. That certainly underscores the enduring bond.
As Professor Tony Travers of the London School of Economics observed, they obviously have a soft spot for the old country.
And it's not just the president. Vance's wife, Usha, also has UK ties, having earned a master's degree from Cambridge. These personal connections seem to be playing a significant role.
It seems so.
Finally, let's turn our attention to the persistent Israel-Gaza conflict, where new constraints and a deepening humanitarian crisis are tragically dominating headlines.
Israel's security cabinet has approved a plan for a more limited takeover of Gaza, specifically focusing on seizing Gaza City.
Which is a narrower objective than Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's previous threats to occupy the entire Gaza Strip.
Right. The shift reflects what the article describes as serious resource constraints and growing military doubts about the feasibility and, frankly, the wisdom of a full occupation.
This brings into sharp relief the intense international and domestic pressures at play. Allies like Germany have openly expressed concern.
Going so far as to suspend arms sales to Israel, fearing the offensive will endanger hostages still held and exacerbate the already dire humanitarian crisis.
Israel's own military chief, Eyal Zamir, has publicly opposed the idea of full occupation, warning of traps set by Hamas, and emphasizing the critical need to give troops rest.
And polling within Israel also shows flagging public support, right? With 79% of Israelis indicating that ending the war for hostage release is the most urgent national task.
Meanwhile, the humanitarian catastrophe continues to worsen dramatically.
The Integrated Food Security Phase classification, supported by the UN, reported that a staggering 86% of Gaza households regularly don't have enough food. Almost everyone sometimes goes to bed hungry.
Starvation deaths and malnutrition are tragically on the rise, and deadly incidents near aid distribution sites are increasing.
Looking ahead, Netanyahu has suggested that Gaza would eventually be administered by Arab forces.
But Arab governments are understandably reluctant to step in, fearing they would be seen by the Palestinian population as foreign conquerors, effectively bailing out Netanyahu's government.
It remains a profoundly complex and tragic situation with no easy answers in sight.
Ew.
The shifting business and tech frontier.
Let's shift gears now to the constantly evolving world of business and technology. We're going to dive into some major innovations in healthcare, the seismic shifts being caused by artificial intelligence, and the ever-churning world of media and consumer trends.
Sounds good. In healthcare, the weight loss medication market continues to revolutionize. Injectable GLP-1 drugs like Wegovy and Zepbound have already generated billions in sales.
Yet, despite nearly three-quarters of U.S. adults being overweight or obese, fewer than 1 in 10 are actually on these drugs.
Exactly. High costs, strict insurance coverage criteria, and persistent supply shortages have really limited their reach so far.
So an oral pill could truly be a game changer for accessibility, right?
Potentially, yes.
Right.
Eli Lilly's oral drug, or Forglipron, recently prompted a significant market reaction, though. It wiped out over $100 billion in market capitalization, sending the company's stock down 14%.
Wow. Why such a negative reaction?
It was largely due to what some analysts called underwhelming results. The pill only achieved an average of 12.4% body weight loss, which is lower than the 15-20% plus seen with the injectable competitors.
Ah, okay. Eli Lilly had originally hinted it could be on par with Wegovy, so expectations were very high.
Precisely. However, the truly significant insight here, I think, is why this pill could still be a profound commercial breakthrough. Its accessibility.
How so?
Well, a once-daily oral drug is far cheaper to manufacture, much easier to distribute, simpler for patients to take, requires no refrigeration.
So it dramatically expands the potential market.
Exactly. It makes it practical for primary care doctors to prescribe, and widely usable globally, where injectables are logistically challenging. It also appeals to patients who are needle-averse or those with milder obesity looking for a simpler long-term maintenance option.
So while the percentage of weight loss might seem slightly less impressive than injectables, its practical advantages could make it a truly massive commercial success, reaching millions more people.
That's the argument, yes.
Speaking of pharmaceuticals, GSK recently received a significant financial boost.
Right. They're getting $370 million as part of a U.S. patent settlement between CureVac and BioNTech related to messenger RNA COVID-19 vaccines.
And on top of that, GSK will also receive a 1% royalty on future U.S. sales of related mRNA vaccine products, including those for influenza and other combinations made by BioNTech and Pfizer.
It's a sizable payout stemming from some complex intellectual property disputes in that space.
Okay, now let's talk about the AI revolution, which one commentator describes as causing quiet havoc on the job market.
Peggy Noonan's commentary, yeah. She asserts that AI is here and a quiet havoc has begun on the job market, rattling nearly everyone with its rapid speed.
And I'm already seeing early economic indicators of this.
It seems so. July jobs growth was lower than expected, and May and June numbers were revised downward. AI is being cited among the causes, alongside tariffs and general economic uncertainty.
What's particularly striking is that it's not just traditional blue-collar jobs feeling the pinch.
No, exactly. There's a surprising difficulty for economists fresh out of school to find employment. As recently as 2023-24, the employment rate for new economics PhDs was apparently 100%.
Wow, 100%.
And now?
Now it's a very different picture. Labor economist Betsy Stevenson notes quite pointedly that the advent of AI is impacting the market for high-skilled labor.
This raises a crucial question about the future of professions traditionally considered secure.
Right. Writer John Ellis, who has been closely tracking the AI story, specifically predicts that companies will employ 10%, 25% fewer people in just 2 to 3 years across fields like, well, insurance brokers, local bankers, mortgage brokers, lawyers, accountants, consultants, marketers, real estate agents, the list goes on.
He uses that compelling example of choosing an advisory firm.
Mm-hmm.
Would you opt for one with JPMorgan Chase's massive AI infrastructure and expertise, or a boutique firm without it?
The answer, he implies, is increasingly obvious. It highlights a fundamental shift in competitive advantage.
So are there any jobs AI won't touch? Well, Microsoft has a list. Floor sanders, roofers, motorboat operators, massage therapists, pile driver operators.
But as Ellis points out, these aren't the jobs found on Old Post Road in those bustling office buildings that typically employ white-collar professionals.
Exactly, which creates a significant challenge for political figures who Noonan suggests are unprepared for the scale and depth of disruption. They're accustomed to addressing cyclical unemployment, not systemic technological redundancy driven by AI.
Okay, moving to Apple's unique stance in the AI race. The technology profoundly challenges Tim Cook's long-standing ethos around user privacy.
Yeah, Cook has consistently maintained that access to all private information is unacceptable, calling it a basic human right.
But the dominant trend in Silicon Valley right now is highly personalized AI, living on devices, constantly listening, watching, recording, processing user data.
gobbling up user data for tailored services, basically. This is what rivals like Meta envision with smart glasses, or what Sam Altman has hinted at for OpenAI with sci-fi-inspired devices.
So how does Cook balance these competing forces, the demands from investors and users for advanced AI, versus his deep commitment to privacy?
Well, Cook has been working diligently to appease investors, emphasizing increased spending and efforts to spread AI features across platforms that are deeply personal, private, and seamlessly integrated. The emphasis is firmly on private.
The core concept Apple is exploring is that its AI might learn the essence of your history of your data without actually needing the full, raw form.
That seems to be the idea. While some on Wall Street are frustrated by Apple's perceived slow pace, its unwavering adherence to privacy has won it considerable praise. Cook is clearly betting that this long-held belief in privacy will remain a powerful selling tool, differentiating Apple even if it appears slower to market.
Meanwhile, Meta recently settled an AI bias lawsuit with conservative activist Robbie Starbuck.
Right. He had sued after Meta's AI model purportedly linked into the Capitol riot in QAnon, raising serious questions about algorithmic fairness.
As part of the settlement, Starbuck will now advise Meta on removing political bias from its AI tools.
Correct. He stated his goal quite clearly: ethical AI that remain neutral on political issues. This is particularly noteworthy given Starbuck's prior efforts to pressure companies on DEI policies.
Meta's stated objective here is to remove bias from our AI models to make sure that Llama can understand and articulate both sides of a contentious issue.
This settlement has broader implications for how AI is developed and perceived, especially in a politically charged environment. It signals a growing awareness of the need for political impartiality in AI outputs.
From the cutting edge of tech, let's transition to the world of media and entertainment, where mergers, disputes, and market trends are constantly reshaping the landscape.
A key development in sports media is the NFL's acquisition of a 10% stake in ESPN.
This deal transforms TV's most important programming into a two-sided bargaining table for future distribution negotiations. That's a significant shift in dynamics.
Huge. And the question arises, what's the likelihood of political intervention, especially from President Trump?
His enjoyment of NFL controversies and his well-known urge to meddle in giant media deals are certainly factors to consider.
Reuters is already sounding out antitrust lawyers, apparently, and other major sports buyers like Comcast, Netflix, Amazon. They might quietly egg him on, fearing what they see as an improper NFL thumb on the scale in future bidding.
It's certainly a high-stakes move for the NFL, inviting potential scrutiny.
You could speculate on the NFL's underlying motive here. Commissioner Roger Goodell may have struggled to find a direct buyer for the league's Sozo cable network,
potentially leading him to accept an ESPN equity stake as the most viable option,
which could be viewed as a short-sighted decision, given the potential for antagonizing other valuable partners and inviting significant political scrutiny.
In the realm of entertainment disputes, Disney recently settled a lawsuit with actress Gina Carano.
Right, she alleged wrongful firing from the Star Wars series The Mandalorian due to controversial social media posts.
This case is quite revealing. Carano's lawsuit was notably funded by Elon Musk's X and garnered strong support from conservatives who believe corporations unfairly discriminate against people with non-progressive views.
Disney, in its court filings, argued that Carano's public profile was inextricably linked to her role, meaning her comments reflected directly on the company.
Carano, however, countered by claiming that artists do not sign away our rights as American citizens when we enter into employment.
Her social media posts, particularly those related to pronouns and transgender people, led to the trend "Fire Gina Carano." Disney ultimately stated her posts denigrating people based on their cultural and religious identities are abhorrent and unacceptable.
This whole episode really underscores the ongoing tension between corporate image management and an individual's right to free expression in the digital age.
Absolutely.
Now, let's talk about consumer behavior, the persistent impact of tariffs, and how they're shaping corporate performance. We can even glean insights from what Vice stocks are telling us.
Yeah, the market data reveals a stark contrast. Nicotine stocks are soaring, while beer sales are struggling. Molson Coors is finding it difficult to sell beer in the U.S.
But Altria, a major tobacco giant, is seeing its stock climb despite a decline in traditional smoking.
This divergence directly highlights the immense success of Zyn nicotine pouches, which have become the top-selling nicotine product in the country. It indicates a clear shift in consumer preference within the realm of, let's say, guilty pleasures.
Moving to fast food, Wendy's recently cut its full-year earnings and sales outlook after a weaker-than-expected performance in its U.S. restaurants.
Right. This decline is attributed to increased competition and more dynamic consumer behavior, leading to a noticeable drop in customer traffic.
While their international business did see growth, up 8.7%, partially offsetting some of the U.S. weakness.
Higher commodity costs and elevated wage rates also impacted U.S. margins, although improved training and lower turnover did provide some productivity boost.
Under Armour is facing significant headwinds as well. They're struggling with tariffs, hindering their ambitious turnaround plan.
Yeah, they expect their fiscal year profit to be cut in half due to an additional $100 million in costs from these tariffs.
CEO Kevin Plank's vision to transform Under Armour into a premium brand by reducing product offerings and discounts. That's directly challenged by the current trade environment.
Exactly. Lower consumer demand makes it much tougher to cut back on promotions. It illustrates the very real direct impact of trade policy on corporate bottom lines and strategic goals.
Despite these tariff headwinds, the S&P 500 actually posted its best week since June. It seems the start of Trump's sweeping tariffs has failed to damp investor enthusiasm.
Well, yes, but there are underlying concerns. The Institute for Supply Management's Service Sector Price Index hit its highest level since October 2022.
Which, combined with emerging cracks in the U.S. labor market, is fueling stagflation fears among some investors' stalled growth coupled with rising prices.
Right. And July inflation data is due next week. That will provide a critical snapshot of the tariff impact and how a Federal Reserve, increasingly under Trump's sway, might respond.
Investors are increasingly betting on the Fed to cut rates at its September meeting, signaling anticipation of further economic adjustments.
And this tariff turmoil is directly impacting the gold market. Gold futures hit a new record high of $3,488 per troy ounce.
A weekly gain of 2.4%. Why the surge?
It happened after a U.S. agency clarified that import tariffs, which are now a staggering 39%, up from 10%, would apply to 1 kilo gold bars from Switzerland.
According to the Swiss Association of Manufacturers and Traders of Precious Metals, this makes it economically unviable to export them to the U.S.
Which directly causes market disruption and drives up gold prices as a safe haven asset.
Similarly, Jaguar Land Rover is backing its guidance despite taking a significant hit from President Trump's trade policies and the transition of its Jaguar brand to all-electric.
Their revenue fell 9.2%, and profit after tax dropped 51% in the fiscal first quarter, directly impacted by Trump's 25% tariff on top of an existing 2.5% duty on UK and EU-made vehicles.
This forced JLR to pause shipments to the U.S. back in April.
Yes, but the U.K. has since secured a deal dropping the tariff rate to 10% for the first 100,000 British-made cars, and the EU has agreed to a blanket 15% rate. CEO Adrian Mardell expects this to lessen the significant U.S. tariff impact going forward.
Okay. The journal's The Score column highlights a few other stock movers that define the week, reflecting broader trends.
Right. Palantir Technologies, for instance, jumped 7.8% after posting strong results, their first $1 billion revenue quarter, and a notable 53% growth in U.S. government contracts.
This clearly reflects strong optimism around AI and the Trump administration's push for AI adoption across government.
On the other hand, Tesla climbed 2.2% after its board approved a massive $23.7 billion stock award for Elon Musk.
This award is designed to incentivize his focus on the company amidst his various other ventures like Robotaxi, XAI, and SpaceX.
These two examples alone show a market heavily influenced by both cutting-edge technology adoption and the impact of individual leadership.
Now let's look at global commerce, where we see fascinating developments in battery technology and a compelling luxury goods mystery.
The rise of Robin Zeng, founder of Contemporary Amperex Technology, or CATL, is truly a story of modern Chinese economic power. His company is the world's largest producer of mozzarella, but also a battery pioneer.
Currently valued at $40 billion.
Yes, yes. Zeng represents a new type of tycoon flourishing in Xi Jinping's China, one who leverages technological know-how and substantial state investment in strategic industries like EVs and renewables, perfectly aligning with Xi's economic vision.
This connects directly to Xi Jinping's broader economic strategy, which has involved reining in previously freewheeling finance and tech giants like Jack Ma.
And restructuring the entire economy to buttress China against a hostile America. These new billionaires are publicly aligning with Xi's vision of humility, actively avoiding ostentatious displays of wealth.
However, as Desmond Shum, who wrote about navigating wealth through party connections, starkly warns,
entrepreneurs like Zeng remain at the whim of Xi. He adds, chillingly, If you don't understand this, you'll be the first one to be slaughtered.
It's a powerful reminder of the inherent risks in China's state-influenced economic landscape.
Really?
Finally, let's unpack one of the century's most baffling financial sagas, the Hermes mystery. A billion-dollar betrayal and a sudden, tragic death.
Eric Fryman, the financial advisor to Hermes heir Nicolas Puech, died by apparent suicide, adding a dramatic and unsettling turn to this complex story.
The core allegation is that Puech filed lawsuits accusing Fryman of massive fraud.
Fryman, in turn, appeared to confirm that a large chunk of Puech's shares had been sold to rival LVMH, with Fryman contending that Puech himself was part of the plan.
Which Puech vehemently denies, stating quite clearly, "I never had any intention of selling my inherited shares, my family shares."
The legal pressures on Fryman had been intensifying significantly before his death. A French investigation for forgery, opened back in 2015, had gained momentum.
Additionally, the family of a late multimillionaire had accused him of misappropriating assets, resulting in a judicial lien recently being placed on his chalet.
This tragic end to Fryman's life adds yet another layer of intrigue and unanswered questions to an already complex and high-stakes financial mystery. 3. The American identity and societal fabric.
Now let's turn our gaze inward to examine the very fabric of American identity and society. We'll dig into political divisions, heated battles over higher education, emerging public health challenges, and even the evolving influencer economy.
Okay. A deeply concerning trend that continues to shape American identity is how gerrymandering, practiced by both Republican and Democratic-led states, is profoundly deepening America's political divide.
It's actively eroding its identity as a unified nation, creating what are essentially separate spheres, each operating under its own distinct policies.
This leads to a remarkable degree of single-party dominance. In 40 states, a single party controls the House, Senate, and governor's office, a trifecta, or possesses veto-proof power.
The sobering reality is that less than 20% of Americans actually live in a state where the minority party has a meaningful voice in governance. It's a stark illustration of how fragmented our political landscape has become.
And as a direct consequence, we're witnessing stark policy divergence between red and blue states. Abortion, for instance, banned or heavily restricted in about one-third of GOP-controlled states.
Versus protected in every Democratic trifecta state.
Right. Similarly, all GOP trifecta states have passed bans or limits on gender-affirming care for minors. Beyond these, there are sharp differences in employment law, gun regulation, immigration enforcement.
Like the 18 GOP trifecta states supporting Louisiana's controversial law requiring the Ten Commandments in public schools. It's not just policy difference, it feels like a fundamental split in values.
It really does. And this increasingly fuels what we can accurately describe as tit-for-tat legislating.
Texas Republicans, at President Trump's insistence, redrawing House districts and even issuing civil arrest warrants for fleeing Democrats to force a quorum.
In direct retaliation, Democratic-led California and Illinois are considering redrawing their own maps to strengthen their party's hand. New York's Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul Scholl famously declared, "This is a war. We are at war. Bring it on."
We see this pattern repeated. North Dakota's felony ban on certain transgender care versus Minnesota declaring itself a trans refuge state. Or Democratic states passing laws to protect abortion patients from investigations by restrictive states.
If we connect this to the broader historical context, states traditionally served as laboratories of democracy, right? Experimenting with different policies.
But this escalating partisan divide has, ironically, increasingly transformed them into laboratories of conformity.
We see this starkly in book bans, in school libraries, in red states, and, conversely, counter laws in blue states aiming to limit such bans or protect librarians. It's a deeply concerning trend for national unity and open discourse.
Turning to higher education, there are major battles brewing over ideology and funding, with the Trump administration heavily involved.
Yeah. The Trump administration is reportedly demanding a staggering $1 billion settlement from UCLA.
$1 billion? Over what?
It's amidst negotiations over allegations that the school tolerated anti-Semitism and also employed diversity practices that the White House objects to.
And the administration's demands are quite explicit, according to the Wall Street Journal. They're seeking that $1 billion plus a mandate for UCLA to eliminate identity-based preferences for hiring, admissions, scholarships.
They also want UCLA to revise its campus protest policy to prohibit disruptions and appoint an administrator who would report to a resolution monitor to ensure compliance.
For its part, UC President Milliken has defended UCLA's vital work in technology, medical therapies, national security, while noting researchers are already grappling with a federal funding freeze.
And this isn't an isolated incident. The Trump administration is also warning Harvard University that it could take over its patents, valued at hundreds of millions, if a review finds the university hasn't complied with federal law.
This is the latest escalation in the White House's battle with Harvard. Following billions in frozen research money, cuts from future grants, threats to block foreign students, probes into tax-exempt status.
It's a clear pattern of applying pressure. This whole situation hinges on the Bayh-Dole Act of 1980, which generally allows institutions to retain patent ownership for federally funded research.
Harvard, for its part, has already twice sued the federal government over what it claims are improperly cut funding and is awaiting a judge's ruling. It's a high-stakes legal and ideological battle.
Definitely.
Now let's pivot to public health, where we're seeing a surprising resurgence of a disease once thought eliminated. Measles.
Yeah, the surprising surge in measles infections, a disease once considered eliminated in the U.S. due to the vaccine's effectiveness, is now spurring a rapid race to find new treatments.
It highlights a critical, unexpected need for medical solutions where prevention was thought to be enough.
Researchers are actively developing antibody treatments, specifically monoclonal antibodies. These hold the promise to not only treat the sick, but also prevent measles in recently exposed individuals.
Like anti-venom after a snake bite, as one researcher put it.
Exactly. Erica Ullman-Sapphire at Lajala Institute. These treatments would be particularly beneficial for newborns, the immunocompromised, or those with waning immunity, offering weeks or months of protection. Dr. James Crow at Vanderbilt has also reported early success.
This resurgence, however, directly connects to vaccine skepticism, doesn't it?
It certainly seems linked. In communities like the Mennonites in Texas, where vaccination rates are low, there's a discernible lack of trust in conventional medicine.
Dr. Ben Edwards, who apparently hadn't treated measles until this year but now treats hundreds, advises vitamin A and Butzonide.
Right, and he explicitly states his belief that if effective treatments exist, more people might choose to opt out of vaccination, relying instead on post-exposure remedies.
This stance directly contrasts with the CDC's categorical assertion that the MMR shot remains the best and only way to prevent measles.
And it's important to note that vitamin A and Butzonide are not considered measles treatments by public health authorities, though Butzonide can help with complications.
What's particularly concerning from a public health perspective is that Serevir Biopharma, a company launched specifically to develop a measles monoclonal antibody, is openly banking on a continuing decline in vaccination rates to fuel investor interest.
That starkly illustrates the intersection of public health crises and private commercial interests.
Okay, next, let's explore how community and conflict are playing out in the modern influencer economy.
We're seeing a fascinating and contentious situation unfolding around Rachel Swanson and her Camp Nantucket. She's charging $3,800 per camper for a four-day luxury retreat.
But the Nantucket locals are definitely not embracing it. Residents and business owners accuse her of being an interloping influencer, claiming she's soliciting free products and discounted experiences for social media exposure.
This has sparked significant backlash, including an anonymous Instagram account, Nantucket Brief, and a viral Nantucket scammer label from author Sanibel Lazar, accusing Swanson of masquerading as a homeowner.
Swanson, for her part, defends her venture. She explains her background, Oklahoma money, but it's not Nantucket money, and her history of house sitting, which led to Reddit snark pages accusing her of cosplaying.
She offered the sentiment, "Sometimes people want to misunderstand you because it's more entertaining." She views her camp as democratizing luxury travel, aiming to provide access for girls who don't have access to experience it.
It highlights a compelling clash between new models of digital entrepreneurship and established local economies, where value and authenticity are being redefined.
Definitely.
From community clashes, let's move to some poignant personal stories about caregiving and the intriguing concept of generational nostalgia.
Katie Reif's personal essay, "My Aging Mother Has Moved In, It's Complicated," offers a truly candid look. She recounts her almost 90-year-old mother moving into her Brooklyn home.
Rolf admits to an immediate birds-in-my-ribcage panic due to seemingly insurmountable problems, like the walker not fitting or the bed being too high.
She powerfully describes the shrinking of kingdoms for her mother, giving up beloved city views and books for a garden floor apartment.
The emotional complexity of this role reversal is profound. Reif describes an alarming feeling of parenting your parent, a wrongness that's hard to shake.
She captures the unique annoyance parents can cause, hitting a knife's edge due to ancient history always being present. Yet amidst these challenges, new routines develop.
Bringing unexpected moments of peace and well-being, seeing her mother sip wine on the deck or engage playfully in family discussions. She even quotes Gabriel Garcia Marquez, "The secret of a good old age is simply an honorable pact with solitude."
It's a deeply honest, relatable reflection on a universal human experience.
This leads us to consider a fascinating question. Is Gen X nostalgia simply a form of trauma bonding?
Adam Kirsch reflects on how social media algorithms actively try to make Gen X, those born between 1965 and 1980, feel nostalgic for their childhood.
The toughness narrative is certainly prevalent. Gen Xers portrayed as steel-toed souls, the original FO generation, having survived insanely hazardous childhoods.
Metal playground equipment, cars without seatbelts, wandering late, smoking at 10. This narrative is implicitly contrasted with today's seemingly coddled youth.
Kirsch's central theory is that this pervasive nostalgia might actually be a form of trauma bonding, suggesting that Gen X parents might unconsciously feel they could have used more protection, more supervision themselves.
He reminds us of the latchkey kid phenomenon and widespread fears of kidnappings, like Eaton Patz and Adam Walsh, fueling those "Do you know where your children are?" PSAs.
This theory suggests their passive, mocking, skeptical rebellion against the mythically glorious 1960s generation was a response to their unique upbringing.
What's also notable politically is that no one born in Gen X has yet been nominated for president. Current leaders are their parents' age, and 2028 prospects like J.D. Vance and AOC are millennials, described as burning with ideological certainty. It paints a picture of a generation caught between two strong, ideologically driven ones. 4. Passages, pioneers, and perspectives.
Let's transition now to a section where we honor influential lives, explore history through captivating book reviews, and gain some unique cultural observations that often reveal deeper truths.
We begin with a tribute to William H. Webster, a former federal judge who passed away at 101. He is widely credited with restoring public confidence in both the FBI and CIA after scandals in the 70s and 80s.
What's truly unique about his legacy is that he was the only person ever to head both agencies.
His career was defined by an unwavering commitment to integrity. Webster famously stated, "One thing I've tried to do in all my investigations is not prejudge the problem."
More recently, he became a notable critic of President Trump, raising objections to the nomination of current FBI Director Kash Patel.
A longtime Trump ally, yeah.
Yeah.
Webster publicly defended intelligence agencies against Trump's frequent attacks during the Russia probe and even called for Trump's impeachment after January 6th.
He firmly believed the agencies were staffed by law-abiding, patriotic, and dedicated people, underscoring the vital importance of not compromising their independence. His legacy serves as a powerful reminder.
Absolutely. We also commemorate James A. Lovell Jr., the commander of Apollo 13, who died at 97.
His aborted mission, famously marked by "Houston, we've had a problem," became one of NASA's greatest triumphs because he landed back on Earth alive, a testament to human ingenuity.
It's a powerful story of leadership and extraordinary teamwork. Lovell, Fred Hayes, and Jack Swigert, along with Mission Control, scrambled to pull off one of the greatest rescues in history.
They overcame dozens of technical issues, any one of which could have been deadly.
Lovell famously reflected on the lesson. "In the face of seemingly impossible odds, Americans didn't let fear paralyze us. Instead, we joined together, working calmly and efficiently to find a solution. A timeless lesson in resilience."
Okay, let's move into explorations of history and culture, focusing on some insightful book reviews.
Elliot West's The Undiscovered Country is described as a monumental book. It presents a rich and complex story of the Western American frontier from 1754 to 1890.
Not simply a tale of triumph, but a profound look at the human and environmental costs.
Right. The book meticulously details the hardships, the bloody conflicts with Native Americans, and the environmental carnage, with pioneers often viewing vast forests as the enemy to be cleared.
West compellingly highlights stories of mutual misunderstanding and government perfidy, citing the shabby treatment of the Navajos, deported despite military pleas.
What's truly unique is West's biographical thread, weaving the narrative through 7 iconic individuals: Boone, Red Eagle, Crockett, Mangus Coloradus, Carson, Sitting Bull, Buffalo Bill Cody.
Promising to reveal the truth behind their incredible life stories while seamlessly integrating them into the larger Western narrative sounds fascinating.
It does. Another intriguing review is Barton Swaim's take on Wagner and the creation of the Ring. This explores why Wagner's epic Ring cycle still soars despite its challenging length, convoluted plot, and profoundly unsavory associations.
And those associations are indeed unsettling. The book delves into Wagner's virulent anti-Semite views and Hitler's adoration of his music.
With some Ring manuscripts even destroyed in Hitler's bunker, Thomas Mann called the opera an exact spiritual forerunner of modern metapolitical movements.
Yet it also reveals Wagner's own radical past, collaborating with anarchists like Mikhail Bakunin in the 1849 Dresden uprising, leading to 12 years of exile.
What's truly astonishing is the unwavering devotion he inspired. King Ludwig II of Bavaria installed Hans von Bülow, whose wife Wagner had stolen to head a conservatory based entirely on Wagner's principles.
It's a powerful testament to the enduring power of his art, despite his deeply problematic personal history and views.
Moving into economics, there's a critical review of the book Inflation, The Price of Cheap Money. The review strongly critiques its argument, contrasting it sharply with Milton Friedman's theory. Inflation is fundamentally about too much money chasing too few goods.
The review emphasizes that an extraordinary increase in the money supply is both a necessary and sufficient condition for inflation, a core economic principle dating back 500 years.
The review highlights several weaknesses, noting how the authors underplay monetary origins and criticize central banks for hiking rates, like Volcker's intention to arrest money supply growth, not destroy jobs.
It also points out careless errors regarding historical events, like mistakenly stating France demanded indemnity from Germany in 1871.
When it was the other way around. Most importantly, the review argues that the authors suggested remedies, price controls, windfall taxes, government subsidies, are historically abject failures because they address symptoms, not the root cause, excessive money supply.
A powerful argument for understanding underlying economic drivers. To wrap up this section, let's touch on some unique cultural observations.
Rich Cohen's commentary on McDonald's regional menu variations offers a fascinating insight. He discusses items like the McLobster in New England, the Hatch Green Chili Double Cheeseburger in New Mexico, the McTeary in Hawaii.
Not to mention international items like the Greek Mac or poutine. It highlights a paradox, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Ray Kroc's founding vision was rooted in the comforts of an unchanging menu and homogeneity. Yet his plans were overtaken by the desires and eccentricities of diners, leading to an expanded and regionally adapted menu.
It's a fascinating reflection of American heterogeneity ultimately winning out over corporate uniformity.
We're also seeing a recent surge in restaurant memoirs, 25 years after Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential.
This surge isn't coincidental. The hashtag MeToo movement and the COVID-19 pandemic brought new visibility to stories of women and essential roles in hospitality.
And of course, the FX series The Bear played a role, shifting the gaze to line cooks, not just rock star food celebs.
These new memoirs offer a refreshing diversity of voices. Restaurateurs, daughters, sommeliers, line cooks, providing varied perspectives, combining dysfunction and adversity with humor, ingenuity, glamour, grit, and humanity.
It's a welcome departure from the Bourdain paradigm, offering a more complete, nuanced picture of the culinary world, the lifestyle and leisure, trends and tips.
Let's turn our attention now to lifestyle and leisure, diving into wellness trends, practical fashion guides, unique travel destinations, and some enticing culinary delights.
Okay. A truly unique and perhaps bewildering wellness trend comes from Heidi Klum. She recently announced on Instagram she's embarking on a worm and parasite cleanse.
Really? Why?
She revealed her belief that apparently we all have parasites and worms, particularly if consuming raw foods like sushi. She plans to use herbal pills with clove and papaya seeds, plus demetalling stuff.
How long does this last?
Apparently months. And she candidly admits to having no evidence of parasites herself, but believes it's something you're supposed to do this once a year. She added, I don't know what the heck is going to come out.
Well, that's certainly an unconventional approach, driven by social media trends.
Indeed. Another interesting area is the wide, confusing range of facelift costs, swinging from $3,000 to maybe $300,000.
Prominent women like Kris Jenner and Barbara Corcoran have helped normalize the procedure, making it an unabashedly normal and collective obsession.
The factors driving such disparate costs are numerous: location, surgeon's reputation, and demand. Top names book out a year. Procedures easily reach six figures.
COVID-era Zoom demand and doctors' social media activity also drove prices up.
Yes, with some surgeons using high prices as a deterrent for a less desirable patient pool, creating an almost elite club.
What about the often overlooked post-operative costs?
They can be significant. Round-the-clock private nursing can cost $100, $300 plus an hour. Some patients spend more on nursing than the facelift itself.
Then there are luxury recovery centers in hotels, like Immortelle at the Four Seasons LA, starting at $3,200 per night for Reiki and lymphatic massages.
It's a very high-end, often hidden expense that adds significantly to the overall cost.
Okay, let's explore fashion and style guides, starting with the modern challenges of creating an ideal fall wardrobe.
The fashion landscape has dramatically shifted. The past simplicity, where September is the January of fashion, has given way to unpredictable weather, an exhausting supply of content creators, and a relentless stream of microtrends.
Shoppers are frustrated by ballooning prices and poor quality options, noting fabrics are no longer built to last.
So how do you navigate this? For temperature, with hot till November, the advice is modular layering with thinner coats. Mix summer-fall colors and textures.
For inspiration, the shift from print to social media brings oversaturation and lack of authenticity, as many creators are commission-driven.
The solution: seek lesser-known names, explore who favorites follow, consult street-style photographers, and even embrace the joy of old-school media.
The fashion cycle itself, accelerated to constant microtrends, can lead to overconsumption.
The advice is to view mini-trends as creative moments for rediscovery and reinvention of existing items, avoiding FOMO.
For shopping strategy, address the trend of Americans buying 53 items annually but wearing less than half 7-10 times due to subpar materials.
Solution: reject fast fashion, embrace the circular economy, and pre-loved pieces. Invest in quality vintage, leather, cashmere, wool, denim, and good tailoring. Classics like a black wool blazer, cashmere turtleneck, silk camisole are recommended.
Speaking of fashion, there's a humorous account of a shopping trip to find an impressive yet hot, cool, and definitely not forced outfit for a millennial man on a $500, $800 budget.
The struggle was relatable. Hurdles like a $348 cream linen jacket deemed too cult-like, double-breasted jackets making him look like an olive that's exploded, pleated trousers feeling like diapers.
But there were successes. Buck Mason's 346 carry-on suit was a hit for its throw-it-on attitude.
The shoe debate, white sneakers versus loafers, ended with a conversion to Blackstock and Weber's lug sole loafers. $370 sample, the four-wheel drive of loafers, described as streamlined but not flimsy and just a little flashy. Plus the tip for darker socks.
The quest for a superlative shirt led past bland options to 316's $240 short sleeve leisure shirt with a raffish splayed collar, making him look like a classy extra on Miami Vice.
A delightful account of finding style for the regular guy.
Next, let's travel to some unique and enduring destinations.
Hotel Portillo, a 76-year-old Chilean ski lodge, stands out. It has proudly resisted corporate ownership since opening in 1949. The story of Henry Purcell taking over in 1961 is charming, finding it occupied only by a caretaker and his pet sheep, Lumumba.
The hotel has a rich history. Its barroom, redesigned by film director Patricio Guzman, attracting international skiers, Olympians. Legend says the World Cup circuit was dreamed up there over Pisco sours. Fidel Castro visited.
Henry Purcell, now 91, still owns it. His son is GM. It remains small, intimate, 450 beds. The living room comes alive nightly with post-ski, pre-dinner banter among an international crowd, maintaining its unique, independent atmosphere, a rare gem.
Here's a counterintuitive travel tip. Visit Arches National Park when it's hot, July, August, despite triple-digit heat.
Surprisingly compelling advice. The key reason is crowd avoidance. The NPS pauses timed entry slots then, making last-minute trips, hotels, tours, and Moab easier to find.
Practical tips for summer.
Early morning tours, 6:30 a.m., for empty trails, good photos. Multiple quick outings, not long hikes. Light-colored, full-coverage clothing. What you wear is your shade. Leverage Canyonland's paved roads for scenic drives.
Cool-off options.
Paddleboarding tours, hotel pools for less strenuous ways to beat the heat. Makes a summer visit surprisingly enjoyable.
Okay, let's turn now to some fascinating culinary delights and restaurant insights.
A columnist recently tried haggling over wine prices in restaurants, inspired by a reader query.
Did it work?
Well, no sommeliers reported direct haggling, but many described significant bargains offered in August. Turns out, the dog days of August are also the deal days for enophiles, as it's a slow month. C-Star Restaurant offers 50% off bottles under $300 Mondays, free corkage Sundays. Plans a September sale of rare bottles at original prices like a 2008 Harlan Estate cab for $625, half market price. Other deals: half-price wine nights at Perry Sotaqueria, immigrant food restaurants.
So maybe you don't need to haggle if you know where to look.
Exactly. Finally, a look at the Bellini, a classic cocktail. The article discusses a subtly superior version.
Its origin at Harry's Bar in Venice, inspired by Giovanni Bellini's paintings.
This subtly superior version adds raspberries for delightfully pink hue and vanilla from scraped bean seeds in pod for a subtle whiff of whimsy. Makes a summery dessertish nightcap a refined twist on a beloved classic, mobility and innovation.
Finally, let's explore mobility and innovation with a deep dive into the latest in automotive advancements.
Okay, we have a detailed review of the newly redesigned 2026 Honda Passport, specifically the Trail Sport Elite trim. That comes in at $54,355 as tested.
This version is explicitly positioned as off-road capable, directly targeting competitors like Toyota's 4Runner TRD.
Right. And it boasts some serious off-road prowess, which may be a bit surprising for a Honda. It features robust steel skid plates, large 31-inch all-terrain tires,
a shorter front overhang giving a 23-degree approach angle, and tucked exhaust outlets for a 27.1-degree departure angle.
Plus a Class 3 tow hitch with integrated recovery points, making it properly trail-ready. The reviewer vividly described it as, "Mom's new Honda is a ridiculous, unstoppable donkey."
Huh. That emphasizes its surprising capability off-road, a clear departure from traditional family SUVs.
Under the hood, it's powered by a naturally aspirated 3.5-liter V6, delivering 285 horsepower and 262 pound-feet of torque. It's paired with a smooth 10-speed automatic transmission.
And it features a redesigned torque vectoring all-wheel drive system, IVTM4.
Yes, which responds 30% more quickly. It can send up to 70% of torque to the rear wheels and even 100% to a single wheel for maximum traction. It also offers 7 terrain modes, including sand.
So it aims to blend everyday drivability with serious off-road capability.
That seems to be the goal. Inside, the interior is spacious and notably more refined. Standard 12.3-inch touchscreen with Apple CarPlay, Android Auto, Google built-in.
Power-heated front seats, wireless phone charger, LED lighting, powered tailgate, keyless entry.
And the Trail Sport Elite package specifically adds upgrades like perforated leather seats and a Trail Watch camera, which provides crucial bumper-level views for navigating tricky off-road terrain.
But there are some expected trade-offs for this enhanced off-road capability.
Naturally, the aggressive all-terrain tires generate a dull roar at highway speeds and can feel a bit squirmy during cornering, plus slightly reduce fuel economy.
Despite these compromises, the V6 delivers effortlessly potent, well-tempered, and flexible performance, providing a stable and reasonably supple ride for everyday driving.
It seems Honda has successfully over-engineered the donor vehicle to create a truly capable off-road contender that still maintains decent on-road manners. Outro.
And that brings us to the end of our deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Saturday, August 9th, 2025. We've covered an incredible range today.
Yeah, from intricate political and economic shifts influencing global trade and domestic governance, to societal reflections on aging, nostalgia, the impact of tech, all the way to detailed reviews of art, books, lifestyle trends.
It's clear how these seemingly disparate threads weave together to form the complex tapestry of our current world.
Indeed. We've seen how changes in Fed leadership can reverberate, how shifts in supply chains impact what you buy, how societal tensions play out in policy and personal narratives.
The sheer breadth of information in just a single day's news is a testament to the interconnectedness of our lives and the constant evolution of challenges and opportunities.
Absolutely.
As we've explored today's headlines, from AI's quiet disruption of jobs to the deep partisan divides reshaping our national identity, it's clear we're navigating an era where information overload is as challenging as the problems themselves.
So the question for you to consider is, what stands out as the most surprising connection from today's deep dive?
And how might understanding these complex relationships better equip you for the changes ahead?
Something to think about.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.
Stay curious and keep digging beneath the surface.